Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. And this is Mike Fader on The Turning Point. Once again, I want to remind everybody that that listens. If you hear something on the show, or you hear somebody or an opinion or anything that you want to contact me about, if you want to express an opinion, you can best do that by going to the Fader Files, FederFiles.com, FederFiles.com. And there on the left side of the page, the homepage is being revised now. It's got many little tweaks and problems it needs. But on the left side of the page, there'll be a place that says Contact Mike. And that's where you go. And I welcome any kind of connection that you want to set up, any opinion that you have. Doesn't matter whether it's critical or it's praise, whatever. I just want to make sure that what I'm putting out here is what you want to hear. And if you have an opinion, definitely want to hear it. When it comes to today is the this is 16th. And, of course, the news in the world is all about what happened in, well, the news in New York, anyhow, and the news in this country and the news in a lot of parts of the world is about what happened in Paris. I'm not going to address that today, but I will get to that in the next show. Possibly in the one afterwards, because there's so much to be talked about here. But today I want to talk about something which is also current, but it's not just current. It's something that's been going on for many centuries. This is an age-old problem. But right now it's more current because there's a movie out. Some of you may have seen it, called Spotlight. The movie is called Spotlight, and It is about the investigation and the revelations after the investigation of what happened with priests abusing children in Boston back in 2002. And it's a pretty good movie. If you know about all this, and a lot of people know about this situation, certainly if you're if you grew up Catholic and of a certain generation, you certainly know all about it. But the movie will be a kind of revelation to anybody who has never really understood the depth and the breadth of this awful problem in the Catholic Church. And today we have with us somebody who can tell us a whole lot about an organization which is addressing this and about his own experiences. David Cloese, who is the executive director of SNAP, which is short for Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Hi, David.
How are you doing?
Okay. Let me, I have some questions to ask you about SNAP and about other general questions, but I want to just introduce you a little bit to people so they know who they're listening to. Okay. All right. David is the executive director of SNAP, and this has been since 1993. He's traveled and spoken extensively, helping to set up local support groups in more than 65 cities in the United States. In other countries, too?
Yes, we're increasingly growing abroad as well.
Okay. In 2002, Mr. Close, he was one of only four survivors, and keep remembering that word survivors, we're going to talk about that later, to address all of America's Catholic bishops at their historic meeting in Dallas. And you can tell us more about that later, too. He has appeared on 60 Minutes, The Oprah Winfrey Show, Phil Donahue Show, Good Morning America, and been featured or quoted in dozens of newspapers around the world. Also part of David's professional career, I guess before that or alongside that, includes working as a community organizer in low-income neighborhoods and as a union organizer representing low-wage workers. He has also done political and public relations consulting. David Cloese helped elect St. Louis's first African-American mayor, later joining his communications staff. He also helped elect the city's first female prosecutor, D. Joyce Hayes. SNAP is Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Can you tell us something about the history of this organization, how it started, and you know, how it developed from there?
Yeah, we've been around for about 26 years. We started very slow and very small in the late 80s with just a handful of men and women who felt terribly isolated and hopeless and were struggling to come to grips with our own victimization at the hands of priests, nuns, bishops, seminarians. And at first we were strictly a support group, just again trying to piece our lives back together. But eventually we began to see and feel that we couldn't recover while many of the men who committed and concealed these child sex crimes against us were still in positions of power. So we increasingly became, you know, an activist group as well. So we do a lot of public advocacy, trying to expose predators and protect kids and deter cover-ups and reform laws, in addition to the continuing work of just talking one-on-one to each and every survivor who contacts us and helping them, deal with this horrific childhood trauma.
So the SNAP have chapters in various cities?
Yeah, we've got about 70 chapters in the U.S., and as I mentioned, we're growing overseas as well. Our support groups usually meet about once a month, completely confidential, completely independent. We're not part of any, certainly any church group or any other organization. And we, you know, we do just frankly anything and everything we can to help not just the survivors themselves, but of course partners and spouses and loved ones, because this kind of terrible abuse doesn't just affect the individual, of course, but everybody who loves and is around that person.
Well, a lot of things get, if they get, into the bones, into the heart of people, then they inevitably get passed along to other people who are close to those people, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely,
yeah.
Right.
And you yourself had your own experiences, right?
Yeah, I grew up in a devout Catholic family, six kids in rural Missouri, and I was abused for a period of about 4 years by our parish priest. I actually, unlike most survivors, he would always abuse me late at night when the two of us were alone on camping and hiking and skiing and boating trips. We were kind of a working class family, so we didn't have much in the way of vacations and that type of thing. So I was thrilled to go with him on these trips. He would always abuse me at night, and I would be just terrorized, paralyzed, didn't know what was happening, didn't even have vocabulary to understand what was happening. But the next morning, I would always wake up and have absolutely no recollection of it at all.
You blocked it out. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so years later, I did remember the abuse. I confronted him. He admitted it but minimized it. And I came to find out that he had molested three of my brothers as well. So I filed a civil lawsuit. One of my brothers had since become a priest, and I found out later that he himself had molested kids. So I guess the long and short of it is that, you know, I have a lot of motivation around this issue, and, my family still is struggling with all of the after effects of this. My perpetrator, like the overwhelming majority of predator priests, has never been defrocked. He's not working in a church now, but was never criminally prosecuted because of the statute of limitations, and my lawsuit got tossed out because of the statute of limitations as well. But it was a huge, huge turning point for me, because through the litigation, I was basically finally able to take some of my power back and put the shame where it belongs, on him and not on me.
Now, maybe you could talk about this movie Spotlight that's out right now and explain. First of all, actually, I should ask you, because the dates are similar, 2000, the movie concerns events that took place, forever, but then leading up to 2002 when the Boston Globe published a whole bunch of stories about this, a whole lot of stories. And it says here in 2002 you were one of only four survivors. By the way, why do you use the word survivor? Why that particular word?
Well, I often get choked up about this, but, you know, in fact, an awful lot of people who endure what we endured as kids don't survive, and many end up taking their lives, either directly and clearly through suicide or, you know, less directly but equally painfully through addictions and self-destructive behaviors and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We know of, for example, a predator priest out in Kansas who molested dozens of boys, and five of them all committed suicide. So we're grateful to have survived.
Did you have counseling, like psychological help?
Tons and tons.
Yeah.
Individual and group. And I went, I started and attended religiously and still attend our monthly, self-help SNAP meetings here in St. Louis where I live.
Mm-hmm.
If I could get one message out to any survivors of sexual violence, it would be that, recovery is possible. It absolutely is, but you can't do it alone. You absolutely can't do it alone.
I guess like anything else that's traumatic like that and has been something that was repeated or something awful like that from childhood, you have to just keep doing it your whole life. It's something that doesn't just disappear after time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Right. But again, progress is really, progress is possible. I mean, I'm happily married for 27 years and two wonderful kids, and, many, many of our folks are unemployed or underemployed or unemployable, and they are isolated. But we see people getting better all the time in SNAP. The overwhelming majority of people who come to us do, in fact, recover.
Well, that's good to hear. There's got to be hope for people who went through that thing. So in 2002, it says you were one of only four survivors to address all of America's Catholic bishops at their historic meeting in Dallas. What was that?
Well, the Boston Globe, in January of 2002, the Boston Globe published the first of what would turn out to be 600 stories in 1 year about child molesting clerics and about the bishops who concealed their crimes. And that essentially started a wave of public attention and media scrutiny around the country, followed by a wave of really angry parishioners. So in June of that year, the bishops finally relented and they said, well, we've got to do something. And so they had a big meeting and they adopted the first ever abuse policy in the church that was nationwide. Now, I hasten to add that, you know, in our view, it's a very weak and rarely enforced policy that was created more or less for public relations purposes than genuine reform.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first step that bishops as a whole took. The crisis, as you pointed out, has been going on for ages. The very first pedophile priest case in the U.S. to attract national attention was literally 30 years ago in Louisiana. And there have been various waves where there's been some degree of media interest and public interest, and then it waned quickly. But that changed radically in 2002 when this team of Globe reporters really, really started digging. And luckily, they were able to uncover a bunch of long secret church records because a judge ordered these records to be unsealed.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you know, survivors who had tried desperately to warn the public about these predator priests, finally we began to be heard, and it was a real sea change for our movement.
And that is what the movie Spotlight is about. Spotlight is the name of a special investigative unit at the Boston Globe that really shines a light on particular stories and uncovers all kinds of things down, getting down to the bottom of things and reveals it all, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I cannot say enough good things about those folks. They were relentless. They were professional. And they treated survivors with real dignity and respect and compassion. And, you know, the movie is very, very well done and very, very accurate.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that the movie does, and I guess if people haven't seen this already, they probably know all about this situation. they may not know the details. It's worth seeing the movie no matter what you hear about it here today. You know, it's not like I'm not trying to spoil it for anybody. But one of the things that the movie makes very clear, and something that I'm sure you can address, is that it's not just a bunch of out-of-control priests running around doing these things. It's not just that. It's a systemic, institutionalized cover-up that went on at the same time, which is in some ways, well, not personally for each person who was abused, but in some ways almost more of a crime when somebody helps somebody else facilitate this and just keeps covering it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Church officials work very hard to pretend to be ignorant, and they pretend to be shocked when these priests are eventually publicly exposed, whether it's through civil litigation or whether it's through criminal prosecution. But you're absolutely right, Mike, that the in almost every case, when there's even a little bit of digging, evidence emerges that shows that other church officials, usually as high up as bishops and cardinals, knew or suspected these crimes and concealed them. And you are right as well that in a lot of ways is even worse, because if you think about it, right, men who are sexually attracted to kids, they're sick individuals. I don't mean to sound harsh or judgmental, but there's something, you know, deeply psychologically wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
They have a compulsion they can't control. But presumably, if you rise within the ranks of an institution and you become, you know, a powerful CEO like a bishop or cardinal, presumably you don't have a mental illness or some kind of compulsive, sick, twisted drive. And you ought to be able to act responsibly and put the safety and well-being of kids first. But time and time and time again, bishops don't do that. And sadly, I have to tell you, sadly, that continues to this day. And that's very hard for some people to wrap their heads around. It's very counterintuitive. People say, well, shucks, you know, all the embarrassment and the nasty headlines and the mean editorials and the civil lawsuits and the priests yanked out of parishes, you know, surely the Catholic hierarchy is doing better now. But in so many ways, they really, really aren't. And again, you're right, it's not just about the individual clerics who commit the crimes. It's about the collective church hierarchy that ignores them and hides them.
You seem to be making a division there, or you made a division between people who rise to this level and the priests who continue to be predator priests, or the ones that were whose deeds were covered up. But might not that overlap in some cases?
Absolutely. There have been dozens and dozens of bishops who have resigned because they committed child sex crimes themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, you know, remember, this is an institution where no one is to have sex of any sort in the ordained ranks, right? No one is. So if you picture five priests living in a rectory, you know, one of them, you know, maybe, you know, masturbates to pornography. One of them, you know, cruises gay bars at night. One of them sexually hits on adult female parishioners. One of them, takes kids with him when he goes on vacation. Well, the rest of us look at that and realize that only one of these men is likely to be a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
But they each look at it themselves as though we all, you know, all of us have something to hide. Therefore, it makes them extraordinarily reluctant to report their colleagues who might be molesting kids. So you're exactly right. There is overlap.
Well, I mean, has any priest who's been sued? I guess so. What you're saying is that it's very rare, if it ever happens, that somebody is actually arrested and put in jail for this behavior, right?
Yes, it's starting to happen more and more often, but the overwhelming majority of predator priests eventually get suspended from active ministry, but they don't get prosecuted by the criminal justice system, and they don't get disciplined or defrocked by the church hierarchy.
Well, do you think that the criminal justice system should be called in with people like this? I mean, this is what happens with other people who abuse children who aren't priests.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We beg people, we over and over again, we say, look, if you have any suspicions, however slight, however remote, however old, however uncertain, you know, you owe it to yourself, you owe it to your loved ones, you owe it to kids to pick up the phone and call the, you know, independent professionals in law enforcement. I mean, our criminal justice system is far from perfect, of course, but it sure beats doing nothing and letting predators continue to assault kids, and it sure beats reporting this stuff internally to your pastor or to the chancery office or to some other Catholic official, because the truth is that no institution can police itself, especially not, you know, a rigid, ancient, secretive, all-male monarchy like the Catholic Church, with a terrible, terrible track record on this issue. So, yeah, and not only do we have to report to secular officials, but we've also got to reform a lot of these archaic child safety laws that are, in fact, quite predator-friendly and enable those who commit and conceal crimes to get by with it. And specifically, I guess I would start with the statute of limitations, because you see this in the movie Spotlight, basically. You know, one of the plaintiff's lawyers explains to these reporters, look, you know, kids who are molested don't and can't promptly report it. They report it years or decades later when they are finally able to understand how badly they were hurt and when they finally realize that the predator's still likely out there hurting other people. And by that time, a lot of our laws say, sorry, too late. Doesn't matter how badly you were hurt. Doesn't matter how egregious this predator is. You simply can't file criminal charges. You can't file a civil case.
Well, there are reasons why there are statute of limitations. I suppose there are good and bad reasons. There are statute of limitations. But how do you go about, or how is SNAP going about trying to change the statute of limitations, either nationally or statewide or whatever?
Well, it is a state-by-state effort.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't do massive amounts of lobbying, but we sure, when lawmakers do introduce these bills, we show up and we testify. You're right. There are good reasons to have statutes in with respect to some crimes. We believe child sex abuse is not one of those crimes because it is very, very likely to be repeated, right? You don't see a lot of 60-year-old purse snatchers or carjackers,
mm-hmm.
right? You just don't. Some crimes, again, people essentially they tend to be young people crimes. They tend to be crimes driven by financial need, that type of thing. They tend to be driven by, you know, anger. Husband comes home, finds wife in bed with somebody, pulls out a gun and shoots her. So there are crimes like that that are very different than child sex abuse because, again, you're dealing with a deeply, deeply rooted, almost uncontrollable psychological urge. And because, of course, the victims are kids. So, you know, you just don't pick up the newspaper and read about a six-year-old girl who leaves school and jumps on a city bus and goes down to the DA's office and says, my
right.
stepdad is molesting me. That just doesn't happen.
Right.
So because of the inevitable time lag, because the victims are especially vulnerable, and because the crimes are so apt to be repeated, we think the law has to make some special allowances, or else, you know, kids are going to continue to be hurt in massive, massive numbers.
Does it look like there's any hope for that, for a change in the statute of limitations?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, there's a lot of hope, actually. I would say that probably more than half the states in the last decade have extended the statutes of limitations prospectively. In other words, you know, a legislature will pass a law today saying that any kid who's molested from tomorrow onward, instead of having to come forward by age 19 or age 21, he or she will have until age 31 or 41. And that's good. That's you know, obviously very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
But only about a half a dozen states have enacted what we call civil windows, which are even better. These are laws that say basically that the civil statute of limitations is going to be suspended for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, and anybody who was abused by anybody at any time can come forward during that short period and file a civil lawsuit. And the beauty and the benefit of that law is that it exposed predators who are out there right now. Predators who have essentially run out the clock on their earlier crimes, but might still be committing, you know, current crimes. So you often hear Snap talking about how little progress there's been in the church hierarchy, but in the secular world, among legislators and, you know, police and prosecutors and judges and juries and parents, there really has been a lot of progress on things like the statute of limitations and other areas.
Now, you know, you could see this in the movie, and I'm sure you've had this experience, I don't know, maybe with your brothers or certainly with other people who've had this, who this has happened to as children. They would sometimes, maybe often, they would tell their parents about it, right?
Yes.
So then, yes. How did that all work?
Well, a lot of times, I would say the majority of victims never tell anybody, and I really mean never. I mean, we talk to people who are in their 80s who never have told their spouse, for example, or their best friend or their sister. But many do tell their parents, and the good news is that increasingly parents believe their children and take appropriate action.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough, but increasingly that's true. But years ago, parents oftentimes disbelieved their kids or misunderstood and minimized the harm of abuse and said, well, I'm sorry, Sally, that, you know, Father Bob did that. We'll make sure he stays away from you and never does it again,
mm-hmm.
and left it there. You know, it's hard for, I think, a lot of younger people to understand this, but, you know, years ago, priests were considered, you know, God's representatives on earth. They were considered by Catholics almost without exception as good, decent, holy, trustworthy, celibate men.
And representing an institution that, if you go all the way to the top and you believe in it, you know, the Pope is God's, you know, temporal representative on earth, and that filters down. I mean, his authority filters down all the way through the levels of authority to the priest. I mean, that's what's so pernicious about this, you know.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, there's a very, very moving part in the film, in Spotlight, where a victim explains to these reporters, you know, why he didn't stop it, why the abuse happened time and time again. And he basically said, you know, how do you say no to God?
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you couple that with the real real life experience most Catholics have had with priests, it makes it harder to believe that some priest could actually rape a boy or girl, because most Catholics, they have very good encounters with priests. They hear, you know, moving homilies, they go to confession and they're consoled, their mom or dad gets rushed to the hospital with a heart attack and the parish priest shows up and prays over them. So again, I think it's hard for young people especially to understand how much priests were put on pedestals, but they really, really were for many, many years.
And it's, for decades, maybe centuries, right? But but why? Well, so why has that changed at all?
Well, I think this crisis has helped. I think we all have a much more healthy attitude towards authority figures. I think that...
I hope so, because it's not just the Catholic Church. It's the country itself is headed towards what's closer to less of a democracy, put it that way, than it used to be.
Absolutely right. Yes. Absolutely right. I mean, I think that you see it in all, you know, in all occupations. I mean, and people deplore the lack of trust to some extent. But, you know, let's face it, people in authority have abused their power. And one of the consequences of that is that, you know, members of the public no longer hold them in such reverence, and I do think overall
that's a good thing then.
You know, absolutely,
really good. Yeah.
Absolutely, it is, and it's also important again that we see the limitations of people in power. I often say that, you know, the district attorney doesn't go give the Easter homily at the cathedral, right?
Right.
That's what the bishop does, and conversely, you know, the bishop ought not to pretend that he can investigate child sex crimes. He's got to turn that stuff, that file, those files, those reports over to law enforcement. It doesn't happen nearly as often as it should, but we got to realize that people in positions of power can be corrupt, and they can also overstep their boundaries, and neither of those are very healthy.
I think we'll take a short break here, and I have a couple more questions I wanted to ask you, too. Is that all right?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. This is Mike Fader, and you're listening to The Turning Point. And my guest today is David Cloessy. It's Cloessy. Is that a good Irish name?
Yep, sure is.
Okay. Executive Director of SNAP, which is Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And we'll come back in a little bit after this and resume talking to David about what's been going on, what's going on now, and maybe some specific cases that are current. And I had a couple of other general questions to ask. Okay, we're back with David Cloessy. That music is called Scenes from Childhood by Robert Schumann. On the Survivors Network of those abused by priests on SNAP's website, it mentions also it's not just about the Catholic Church. And I, you know, I was looking around on the Internet. And, of course, if there's anything that you can't find on the Internet, I never heard about that. It's so any kind of contradictory thing or whatever, you know, who knows. But I'm sure you're familiar with a man named William Donahue, right?
Oh, sure.
William Donahue is the head, and we know about him very well in New York City. Maybe that's where it's based, because William Donahue has been, he's a man who's was the head of, and maybe still is, the head of something called the Catholic League. And one of the things they do, for instance, if you ever see people picketing anything, if there's any artwork at a museum or a gallery or a movie that they feel is anti-Catholic, you'll see people picketing outside saying that this is, bigotry against the Catholic Church and against Catholicism. And it's always this guy, William Donahue. And what is the Catholic League, anyhow?
Well, I think it's...
In your unbiased Donahue, opinion.
in my unbiased opinion, I think it's basically, you know, Bill Donahue's source of income and his soapbox.
But not backed by the Church, right?
Well, no. Certainly, he gets support from bishops.
Okay.
He does, and he, there's just, I don't even know how to put this. I mean, he kind of, the current flap over the Starbucks cup.
And sure. It's anti-Christmas, so right?
Yeah. Right. And so Bill Donahue, I think, is in a lot of ways the pioneer of this ginned up kind of phony campaign, taking offense at every depiction of the Catholic Church. He's just a very, very loudmouth bully in a lot of ways. And, you know, it's particularly hurtful when he goes after victims of child sex crimes.
Yeah, that's why I'm bringing him up, in case anybody's wondering why I mentioned him. I mean, the last article I saw was 2011, but there might be more recent articles. It's about... Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests National Conference in Washington, D.C. in 2011. And I'm not going into the details, but he goes so far as to admit that much of the criticism from SNAP and other people about the predatory priests has been constructive and to that extent welcomed, yes, I'm sure. But he does say this is precisely what has happened to SNAP and to its allies, specifically meaning that logic, reason, and evidence is no longer matters. What matters is payback. Make no mistake about it. SNAP has decided to wage war on the Catholic Church, and I don't really think that makes any sense at all. I mean, you're just trying to help people who have been hurt. But has your organization been accused of trying to destroy the Catholic Church? Because a lot of these civil suits have brought some parish or some diocese to bankruptcy, right?
Well, let's see where to start. Yes, we've certainly been accused of trying to destroy all kinds of faith groups because, as you point out, we help people who are abused in any kind of an institutional setting, religious or secular. So, for example, you know, we've talked to some of the victims of Jerry Sandusky at Penn State, and we've helped victims of Boy Scout leaders, and on and on. And you're also right that a handful of dioceses have declared bankruptcy. Quite honestly, though, it's not because of the money. What church officials have learned over the years, basically, is that if they can stay out of the courtroom, if they don't have to face tough questions in open court under oath about how they shuffle these predator priests, if they can avoid that, then they're safe.
Mm-hmm.
They'll never miss a day's. They'll never miss a paycheck. They'll never take fewer vacations. They'll never get demoted. They'll never get disciplined by the Vatican. So that's what the number one goal of bishops is. And that's the beauty, in their eyes, of bankruptcy. Because once you file bankruptcy, all civil litigation stops. All depositions, all discovery, all trial, all of that stops.
Hmm.
And the question then shifts from how much did the church hierarchy know about these predators? The question then becomes, how do we divide up these dollars? So bankruptcy is a real shrewd legal maneuver on the part of Catholic officials. They can shrug their shoulders and pretend to be penniless and powerless, and effectively keep a lid on all of the corruption. So it's a very, very tempting legal option. And I have to say, this is one of the most, most kind of pathetic claims that Donahue makes, is that we're all about payback, because I've done this 26 years. I literally have talked to thousands of men and women and teenagers who were sexually abused by clergy. And I'm stunned. I am stunned at the lack of anger and vengeance. I am consistently in awe of how much incredible compassion SNAP members have and other survivors have for kids, for even sometimes for these corrupt church officials. I mean, our folks just want to make sure that other kids don't suffer like we've suffered. Mm-hmm. That's it, plain and simple.
So the Christian concept of I'm calling it a Christian concept. It's not a Christian concept, but the whole idea in Christianity of forgiveness, right? Loving yeah. people and forgiving people. That's not something that's being thrown overboard, right? I mean, do you feel like vengeance is not a main theme that runs through SNAP's behavior or its institution?
It's not even a minuscule theme. It's not even on the charts. And you know, that's we tell all of our folks, you know, please go see professional counseling. And counselors tell victims the same thing. Look, you know, you got to let go of some of this anger and this frustration, and you've got to, you know, move beyond it, and you've got to focus on yourself and your healing and on the protection of other people. It's just, you know, we don't, there's no one size that fits all, and we certainly don't try, you know, tell victims, here's what you must do if you want to recover. But the overwhelming majority of people in our organization flat out say, oh my gosh, yes, I forgave my perpetrator, you know, years ago. I forgave that bishop, you know, decades ago. But it's a very convenient sort of political tactic and PR tactic to assail the motives of the people who are uncovering, you know, your corruption. And the easiest way to do that is to say, oh, these victims, they just want to crush the church, when in fact, you know, we just want to make sure that kids aren't hurt.
Well, the other assertion is that there's a lot of lawyers who are making an industry out of suing the church. You know, that's the other assertion. So, the people who have never experienced a trauma like that, they couldn't possibly understand that the motive is just to climb out of a personal hell, and it has nothing, and whatever else happens, that's beside the point. So,
and to again expose those who commit and conceal child sex crimes, I'm going to just make a guesstimate here. I honestly believe, Mike, that 80 or 85% of the people who come to us in desperation because they, first of all, have reported their abuse through the church channels. You know, they've said over and over again to monsignors and priests and pastors and even bishops, hey, the priest who molested me is still in a parish. And nothing happened. And then they went to police. And the police were told either, you know, you don't have much in the way of evidence, or it happened too long ago. And then they either come to us or they come to a civil lawyer in desperation saying, look, every night I put my head on the pillow, every night, and I think, my gosh, is he doing that to some little girl, you know, tonight? And so, you know, yes, victims sue. The majority don't. And the majority of victims who do sue lose in court because of the statute of limitations and because the church has really shrewd lawyers. But the victims who sue because they are out of options. There's no other way to expose this corruption and stop this horror.
But it does give them, as you said, a sense of power and a sense that they're not helpless victims forever, right?
Exactly. Like I said, everybody heals in different ways, but I think one common denominator is that victims begin to heal when we start, you know, taking tangible steps. Just kind of feeling mired and trapped and stuck in depression and shame and confusion and self-blame. You know, there are not a whole lot of ways to get out of that mess. One of them is therapy, and the other one is to start doing something practical and tangible.
Now, I've known a lot of, you know, I grew up in New York City, and I've known a lot of people who consider themselves what they call ex-Catholics. You know, that they were when they were children, and they have their own stories about abuse or near abuse, or, you know, the usual story of being smacked around by nuns or even priests, you know, a capital punishment kind of thing, and, you know, like corporal, I should say, corporal punishment. And so a lot of people consider themselves that they just turn their backs entirely, not only on the Catholic Church as an institution, but on Christianity and any kind of religious faith. And it took them a long time to recapture either their original faith or any faith at all. And I'm not saying, suggesting people need to have that to survive, but any kind of spirituality or faith in any kind of thing. Were you at one point religious? Did you struggle with that? Have you given it up? Do you still consider yourself at all religious? Or what's your state about that right now?
I'm essentially an agnostic. Most of our members, most of the people in SNAP, do follow exactly that trajectory you just described. And usually there are years or decades of sort of spiritual doubt, estrangement, wandering, loneliness. And eventually many of our people, I wouldn't say most, but I would say many, do find some kind of faith life again. I have not, mm-hmm. and I have very, very, you know, mixed feelings about that. I used to say in the early days of my recovery that I'd lost my faith, but I stopped saying that because I realized that kind of minimizes it. I mean, I lose my car keys and I lose my jacket, but yeah. My faith, I believe, was really stolen from me.
Yeah. What about the church itself? Do you see, I mean, the church, you know, been around for millennia, you know, actually, you know, like, you know, centuries at least, you know, organized church, done a lot of harm and maybe done a lot of good. I mean, in New York City, which is what I know about more than anything else, is New York City Foundling Hospital, you know, institutions of learning, various other kinds of hospitals, charities, clinics, Catholic charities, helping people who were in poverty. Is there any good to the Catholic Church? I mean,
tons and I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
You're exactly right. Tons and tons and tons of good, and that is yet another part of this tragedy. Is that you know, the few men at the top, the bishops and the cardinals and the popes, you know, they've squandered so much goodwill, and they've crippled so much in the way of good ministry. Because they act so selfishly and so recklessly and so callously in clergy sex abuse cases. You know, it's heartbreaking for me personally to see lawmakers trying to end capital punishment in some state and seeing, you know, bishops lobbying for an end to capital punishment. I'm opposed to capital punishment, always have been. But to see the death penalty opponents win, in part because the clout of bishops has been diminished, but by their own accord, because of their own complicity in this abuse scandal. It's just tragic when you think about. Again, there's victims, there's kids, there's the victims' loved ones. There are all the betrayed feelings and hurt feelings and confusion among parishioners. But then, when you take it even one circle, one step further out, there is the loss of moral stature and moral capital and political clout that has so often been used in good ways. Obviously, it's been used in bad ways as well. But, yeah, it's heartbreaking to see that that good that was happening is happening less now in the church because so few people have so little trust in bishops anymore.
And as you mentioned a couple of times, and as the website mentioned, SNAP doesn't just keep its activities limited to the Catholic Church. You're involved with any kind of institutionalized predation like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely, because it's the same.
And other religions too?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, it's the same basic dynamic, right? You've got an individual perpetrator who is, in essence, aided and abetted, either directly or indirectly, through action or inaction, by colleagues and supervisors, usually in a very popular and sometimes very powerful kind of institution. And so it's really, really hard for victims to expose their perpetrators, you know, when nobody wants to say anything bad about our fellow Lutherans or our, you know,
right,
fellow Presbyterians, or even, again, in secular institutions like Scouting. I mean, the Penn State, I think, has been very important and illustrative for people because, you know, here there's no religious component, right? There's just intense, intense pride in a college and specifically in a football program. And I think everybody now realizes that, that there were officials at that university who should have said more.
We only have like about a minute or two left. David Closey, who is executive director of SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, has been talking to me, and I really appreciate you doing that. I guess
my pleasure.
one last question, and we only have like a minute left. Is do you have hope with this? Do you have any hope because of Pope Francis? Is he giving you any sense of hope about what the future is?
Sadly, he's not. He's terrific on so many other issues, and he's given so many Catholics and so many citizens so much hope. But unfortunately, on this issue, he is no better than his predecessors. And so we constantly remind people that, you know, change comes from the bottom up, and that even if you think Pope Francis is perfect, you know, he cannot do it alone. And it's up to every single person who sees or suspects or suffers abuse. Every single one of us just has to speak up,
okay,
no matter how awkward, no matter how uncomfortable, no matter how embarrassing, and no matter how hopeless it feels. We've got to speak up because that's the only thing that will protect kids.
Last thing, for people who have suffered and for people who want to know more about this or need help, what is the website and how do people get in touch with SNAP?
SNAPnetwork.org, SNAPnetwork.org. And please, please, please call us, contact us at any time. My name and number and email are on the website. About 60 other leaders are across the country. You gotta break your silence if you hope to rebuild your life. But you can do it.
Thank you so much for coming on and spending so
Thank
much
you,
time
Mike.
With us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Very much appreciate it.
You're welcome. Okay, that's it for today. In upcoming shows, I'm developing, looks like I'm going to be developing a second radio show called The Interview Show, although I do a lot of interviews on this show. And we're going to be talking to people politically, about politics, about culture, about their personal lives, about all kinds of things. And that will be on Fridays. I'm not sure when it will be broadcast exactly. But as for today, that's it. And we'll be back next week with another guest or with another topic I want to talk about. Thank you. Wind.
see.